ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 37, The Killing of Keshi and Vyoma, Text 3-6.
Dantana peto bhagavat bhuja sprishas Te keshina saptamaya sprisho yatha Bahushtata deha gato mahatmano Yathamaya sambhavrade upekshita.
Translation of text 3-6. Seeing the Lord standing before him, Keshi ran toward him in extreme rage, his mouth gaping as if to swallow up the sky. Rushing with furious speed, the unconquerable and unapproachable horse demon tried to strike the lotus-eyed Lord with his two front legs. But the transcendental Lord dodged Keshi's blow, and then with his arms angrily seized the demon by the legs, whirled him around in the air, and contemptuously threw him the distance of 100 bow lengths, just as Garuda might throw a snake. Lord Krishna then stood there. Upon regaining consciousness, Keshi angrily got up, opened his mouth wide, and again rushed to attack Lord Krishna. But the Lord just smiled and thrust his left arm into the horse's mouth as easily as one would make a snake enter a hole in the ground. Keshi's teeth immediately fell out when they touched the Supreme Lord's arm, which to the demon felt as hot as molten iron. Within Keshi's body, the Supreme Personality's arm then expanded greatly, like a diseased stomach swelling because of neglect. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti points out that although Lord Krishna's arm is more tender and cooling than a blue lotus, to Keshi it felt extremely hot, as if made of lightning bolts. Om Agana Chimadam Dasya Agyanam Jana Shalakaya Chakshu Vitamyena Tasmai Shri Guru Vena Maha. We're in the midst of hearing about Kamsa's last attack on Vrindavan itself. Very soon, Kamsa is going to have the opportunity to attack Krishna in Mathura. The Lord will go to Mathura to give Kamsa that last hope and pleasure. Right now, Krishna is in Vrindavan, and it's time for him to go to Mathura. You heard how Narada Muni acted as an agent in the Lord's pastimes by instigating Kamsa to get him moving, to get the whole Leela moving in its proper way. The Lord's devotees, they participate in the Lord's pastimes, and if they're very expert, they can also help the Lord's pastimes, push on the Lord's pastimes. Narada Muni, he's playing that role. He went to Kamsa, as you heard in the last chapter, and spilled the beans. He told everything. Kamsa, that Krishna you're looking for, he's been raised by Nanda and Yashoda. Vasudeva and Devaki, they cheated you. They sent baby Krishna to Vrindavan. And all the demons that you've been sending to Vrindavan, looking to kill young babies, hoping that one of them would be Krishna, all those demons have been killed by Krishna. You heard how when Kamsa heard that, he was enraged. What was his first step? To kill Vasudeva and Devaki. He brought out his sword. But Once again, Narada Muni intervenes in this whole unfolding of events. Narada Muni is so expert. He can push on the pastime on behalf of Krishna, and Narada Muni can intervene to make sure things are going the right way. So when Kamsa made his move to kill Vasudeva and Devaki because he felt cheated, what did Narada Muni say? Wait, you're going in the wrong direction here. It's not Vasudeva and Devaki who are supposed to kill you. Remember, it's Krishna. He's the one. So just point your sword in the right direction. In this way, Narada Muni is helping the flow of the whole scene. And Kamsa was submissive. Yes. So many words you could say. Kamsa readjusted himself. Oh, not Vasudeva and Devaki. All right, I'll just throw them into jail and shackle them. But Krishna, yes, he's the one I should focus on to kill. That's right. That's completely right. So, Kamsa called for various advisors about how to arrange the wrestling match for killing Krishna and how to arrange for Kuvalayapi, the elephant. One way or another, Kamsa was going to try to get his mission accomplished. And he also sent two last demons to Vrindavan, Keshi and Vilma. Kamsa doesn't understand he's sending these demons to their death. So he felt, with all these arrangements, the wrestling match, Kuvalayapi, the elephant, Keshi and Vilma going to Vrindavan, something was going to work. This is Kamsa's paradox. He knew that he's dealing with Vishnu, and he knew Vishnu cannot be killed. Still, he was dedicated to killing Vishnu. This is the mystery of Kamsa's life. On the one hand, he knows he's Vishnu, Vishnu cannot be killed. On the other hand, I have to kill him. Can you imagine having your whole life possessed by this kind of paradox or contradiction? Your whole life is dedicated to doing something which is impossible. But you're going to try to make it possible even though you know it's impossible. This is Kamsa. And this kind of paradox and contradiction in Kamsa produced such an intense meditation on the Supreme Lord. You can imagine if you have to do something which is impossible to be done, but you still have to try to do it. This produces such an internal absorption. You know what it's like when you've had some intractable or apparently insolvable problem in your life. It just consumes your whole consciousness. You're worrying about it, how to deal with it. Could I try this way? Could I try that way? No, nothing seems to work. But something has to work. This consumes your whole being. So this is what's happening to Kamsa in a much more intense way, because he's dealing with Vishnu. I have to kill him, otherwise he'll kill me. He can't be killed, but I must kill him. You know the description from Krishna Lila of Kamsa's meditation, how he thought night and day to get this job done. So he's making his last efforts now, and he feels they're quite sufficient. He reveals that to Akrura. Kamsa calls Akrura forward, and in a very diplomatic way, he tells him, "Akrura, I have no better friend than you in the Yadu dynasty. I'm taking shelter of you just like Indra takes shelter of Vishnu. I've got a scheme I want you to execute. And I've got a brand new chariot. That'll blow your mind. You get to ride on this brand new chariot if you carry out my order." And anyone would like such a flash chariot like this. This is how Kamsa was thinking of it. Many people think, Vaishnavas, they're very sentimental. They can easily be swayed. They have this thing about Krishna Bhakti, worshipping the Supreme Lord. This is their sentiment. But in the right situation, under the right kind of pressure, anyone will give up their God consciousness for the wonders of material pleasure and opulence. It's like, I remember, someone was telling Stalin, the dictator who ruled Russia in the past, that the Pope, the head of the Catholic Church, is a very powerful person. And what was Stalin's reply? He's very powerful. How many divisions of armies does he have? Or that's his mentality. Power? That means he must have an army. Where is it? So similarly, Kamsa is thinking about Akrura. Well, I got something he can relate to. Everybody likes fancy chariots. Everything is mundane. So, here's a beautiful chariot. He'll certainly be swayed. Anyone would be swayed. So, what was Akrura thinking? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives the insight. Akrura is not thinking, oh, wow, I get a chance to ride on a flashy new chariot. Certainly I'll execute this chore. No, what is Akrura thinking? I'm glad it's a brand new chariot to bring Krishna and Balaram to Mathura, because I wouldn't want to go bring them back on any chariot that Kamsa has already ridden on. So this is a difference. That's why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, what is night for the materialist is day for the transcendentalist, and vice versa. They have completely two different ways of looking at things. Kamsa was sure his mind will be blown. Akura's mind will be blown by the flashy chariot, and that will get him to do my evil plan. And Akura had completely the opposite vision. I'm glad it's a new chariot. I don't want you to have desecrated any chariot that I'm supposed to bring Krishna and Balaram back to Mathura. So then Kamsa spills the whole plan. He doesn't mind saying these things to Akura, obviously. He reveals his whole strategy. I'm going to kill Vasudev. I'm going to kill my own father. I'm going to kill my uncle. I'm going to make alliances with so many other demoniac leaders. Together, we'll drive out the demigods and their supporters. And then Kamsa made a statement presented by Prabhupada in Krishna book, which strikes a chord with our material psychology. Kamsa said, once I do this, once I rid the earth of these thorns, the demigods, the Yadu dynasty, once I get rid of all these people, it will be very pleasant to rule the world without obstruction. You can feel that materialistic desire well up in you. This is the cause of our implication in material existence. We actually see that possibility. It will be very pleasant to enjoy sense gratification without obstruction. Does that ever happen? Have you ever experienced sense gratification without obstruction? No. What does Prahlad Maharaj say? He says, as soon as you make your plan in your mind for sense gratification, that is where the distress begins. Not simply in the deed, but just in the plan-making stage. As soon as you start making plans for material enjoyment, you can mark it. This is where the distress begins. So we have this kind of urge welling up in us. We have this kind of psychology because of contact with material nature. And this body and mind are products of contact with material nature. It is not that we just wander around in material nature, learning our lessons, as the New Agers say, without getting reactions. Material nature doesn't offer any free lunches. If you wander around in material nature, you'll be contaminated. That's why Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Kananam Guna Sangasya Sarasa Yoni Janmasu. The living entity makes his way through material nature and in this way picks up various influences, picks up various viruses because of contact with material nature. Guna Sangha. Because of the Sangha with the Guna, with the modes of material nature, then there are problems. So, our association with material nature has brought about this mentality of, I would like to enjoy without impediment. And you can little bit sympathize with Kamsa having this kind of psychology to a raging degree. But we cannot exempt ourselves completely from this kind of mentality. We can use kamsa to see in our own hearts little kernels or little particles of this same desire that kamsa expresses so royally. It would be very pleasant to rule the world without obstruction. This is the disease of the conditioned soul. I'm going to build something in this world that will bring happiness. I'm going to erect something, construct something, which will provide some tangible, substantial happiness. Now, Prahlad Maharaj says, as soon as you start thinking like that and planning, mark it, that's when your problems begin. That's when your distress begins. So, Kamsa presents his plan to Akrura. And what is Akrura's response? Very tactical, polite, and diplomatic. Your plan is very expertly formulated to counteract your distress and accomplish your purposes. I might add that we make so many plans, but destiny has its own way. But in any case, I must admit, your plan is very expert. This is Vaishnav, giving credit where credit is due. You've come up with a great plan to kill Krishna, who can't be killed. And I know you're going to die soon, but still, I have to compliment you. Very good military strategy. We'll give credit where credit is due. A very wonderfully formulated plan how to kill Krishna who can't be killed. So this is Akura's humor. So Akura concludes by saying, very well, I will accomplish your purposes. Especially, of course, Akura knew, by accomplishing what you've told me, I'll be bringing about your death. And you heard the explanation why Vasudeva was not angry at Narada Muni for instigating Kamsa. Narada Muni spilled the beans, as we said, told Kamsa, Vasudeva and Devaki, they tricked you. So, normally, if somebody spills the beans on you, if someone, reveals all your schemes, you get angry at that person. I'm sure you've had that experience sometimes, that you thought someone was trusted, and then they told somebody else all your schemes and all your plans. It's not very nice. But Vasudeva was not angry at Narada Muni. What was Vasudeva thinking? First of all, Narada Muni is just speeding things up so that Kamsa will die. And secondly, by Narada Muni's manipulations and schemes, he's bringing Krishna and Balaram to Mathura, our long-lost boys. So therefore, Vasudeva was in full support of Narada Muni's intricate manipulations. All right, now we're in Braj, and the Keshi demon is making his attack. He's full of anger. He's frightening the whole village of Gokul by his sound, and by his shaking the clouds. So Krishna did not appreciate that Keshi was frightening the village of Gokula, because the Lord is the protector of Vrindavan. He's the protector of his devotees. That in of itself, that Keshi was disturbing Vrindavan, brought a reaction from Krishna. So Krishna came forward to meet Keshi. Keshi wanted to fight, and Krishna was going to reciprocate with Keshi, and in this way, the Lord enjoys a particular variety of pleasure. So, you're hearing very vivid descriptions about Keshi. How he ran towards Krishna with extreme rage. You can just try to feel what it's like to have extreme rage. And then your mouth is wide open as if you swallow the sky. And then you rush with furious speed, and you feel unconquerable. Sometimes people feel like that in material life. They think it's the greatest feeling in the world. They call it like the magic moments of life. When you just feel that everything is going your way, you feel unconquerable, you feel on top of it all. Materialists love those moments. They call them moments to savor all your life. And then when you're old and gray, you can tell your grandchildren about those moments when you felt like everything was under your control. Especially sports stars, you know, they remember these moments when they did something invincible. Politicians remember a great political victory. So everyone wants their life to be filled with at least a few of these magic moments. And then they feel that their life has been worth it. Casey, he's got that magic feeling, magical feeling. The Bhagavatam says he's ordinarily unconquerable and unapproachable. Of course, Krishna is actually Ajita, unconquerable, and Krishna is Adokshita, unapproachable, but Keshi is feeling that material empowerment. So he rushes towards the Lord and tries to strike the lotus-eyed Lord with his two front legs. He's dealing with Aravinda, Aravinda Locha, the lotus-eyed Supreme Lord. So beautiful that you can only offer a material example of a lotus flower to try to get some idea of Krishna's beauty. Keshi is not worried about appreciating the Lord's beauty, though. His purpose is to kill the Lord. Nevertheless, regardless of Keshi's rage, with his mouth gaping wide open, running at a furious speed of the mind, the Lord's beauty is an eternal fact. The Lord's beauty can never be disturbed by any material condition. That is God. Krishna doesn't have to worry about maintaining his good looks amidst the crisis. Still, sometimes the Lord adjusts his clothes as if they're in disarray, but whatever way his clothes are, whatever way his hair is, it's infinite beauty. But just for his own sweet pleasure, the Lord appears to make an adjustment on his clothes or like that. Everything the Lord does is infinitely beautiful. Just like when the Lord prepared to jump into the lake after the Kaliya demon. He stood on the tree that Garuda's nectar had preserved. And just before jumping into the Kaliya lake, the Lord adjusted his belt, making sure everything was in proper style. Because Krishna is the supreme artist. Now, it's not that before he adjusted his belt, this was not the perfection of beauty, but the Lord is full of infinite variety. So he decided, let me adjust my belt another way. And this way, Krishna is always experiencing infinite varieties of pleasure. Now, the Keshi demon is rushing towards the Lord, and that rushing of Keshi, so furious, running at the speed of mind, does not disturb the Lord's beauty. The Lord is still known as Aravinda Lochan. And how did Krishna respond? He dodged Keshi's blow. And then with his arms, he grabs Keshi by the legs, twirls him in the air, and throws him. This is real enjoyment. Die, die. We have to appreciate Krishna's pastimes in killing demons, just as we appreciate Krishna's pastimes in dancing with the gopis. Whatever the Lord does, it is the summit of pleasure. So, just visualize the artistic and classy way that the Lord kills Keshi. And grabs the demon by the legs, whirls him around the air, and then throws him. This is pleasure. Now, this knocked Keshi out for a while. But then Keshi regained consciousness, and he gets up even more angry. You may say, why didn't Krishna kill him immediately? Is the Lord not powerful to kill Keshi immediately? But you see, Krishna wants to enjoy in different ways. Sometimes he kills demons immediately, and sometimes he plays with them. So this time he threw Keshi, and it didn't kill Keshi at once. So Keshi regained consciousness to attack the Lord and give the Lord more fighting pleasure. So Keshi opens his mouth wide. This time he opened his mouth just one time too much. And he rushed to attack Lord Krishna. Was Krishna afraid? No, Krishna just smiles. Another way to enjoy. How does he do it? He takes his left arm and pushes it into the horse's big mouth. Now, how does Keshi feel that arm to be? Immediately when Keshi's teeth touch the Supreme Lord's arm, all his teeth fall out, and the demon feels the arm of the Lord to be as hot as molten iron. Is Krishna's arm always giving that kind of feeling? No. The Lord is the perfection of reciprocation. The same Supreme Personality of Godhead can perfectly reciprocate with unlimited living entities according to their desire and what they deserve. That same Krishna, who is so sweet and beautiful to his friends and lovers, he can be death personified to the demons. So that arm of the Supreme Lord, as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out, although Lord Krishna's arm is more tender and cooling than a blue lotus, to Keshi it felt extremely hot, as if made of lightning bolts. This is Krishna's perfect ability to reciprocate. And this is a main reason why we are dedicated to becoming Krishna conscious. We have the conviction that Krishna can perfectly reciprocate our love. This is what drives the devotee onward. I know that I'm dealing with the perfection of love. I know that Krishna can perfectly reciprocate with me. Material life means frustration and impediment when it comes to reciprocation. Things never go the way you want in your relationships. There's always some dissatisfaction. There's always some problem. But with Krishna, there is perfect reciprocation. That is why Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this reason is even more important than Krishna creating, Krishna maintaining, Krishna destroying. The most important thing about the Supreme Personality of Godhead is that he can perfectly reciprocate with any living entity. So that same arm, which is so sweet to the devotees, feels like hot iron to Keshi. That same arm. Now, the residents of Vrindavan, particularly Krishna's confidential devotees, the gopis, they get a different experience completely from Krishna's arm. What is that prayer when Uddhava comes to Vrindavan to deliver the message of Krishna to the gopis? And the gopis are pouring out their hearts, and Krishna's dearest consort says, when will Krishna come back to Vrindavan and put on our heads his guru-scented hand? That's what Krishna's dearest devotees feel. They're longing for that guru-scented hand to touch their head. But what is Keshi getting? He's getting the hand too. But he's feeling that hand to be as hot as molten iron. And all his teeth are falling out. Showing you that the same Krishna can perfectly reciprocate with anyone. Now, you might wonder. Keshi's angry. So many verses are describing Keshi's anger. He's raging in an extreme way. But what about the Lord? The Shastra, text 4, also says that the Lord angrily seized the demon by the legs. Now what is this? How can the Supreme Personality of Godhead be angry? Isn't anger a contamination? So this is a point that impersonalists can't handle. How can Krishna be the Supreme Personality of Godhead and, first of all, be full of such variety, and one of those varieties is anger? To an impersonalist, to a Mayavadi, it's quite clear that all these different emotions are illusions, and you should go beyond them, especially anger. But there's a great difference between material anger and the Lord's Vishuddha Sattva anger. Perfectly pure. The devotees glorify anything and everything about Krishna, even his anger. The Lord's anger is full of Satchitananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Just the same as his smile. In text 4, he's angry. And in text 5, he's also smiling. All these things are pure and worshipable. Because in the perfection of the Supreme Absolute Truth, everything is there, but it's there without any material contamination. So Krishna is demonstrating the full range of possibilities in his artistic expression. Whether his artistic expression, his personal expression, is angry or it's smiling, still it's 100% pure. And the devotees glorify Krishna for however he expresses himself. Keshi will meet his death, as you'll hear tomorrow, and then one more demon will come. But you can feel the anticipation building now that very soon the Vrindavan Leela is coming to an end and the Lord is going to Mathura. And the residents of Vrindavan are going to be apparently bereft of the Lord's association. You can feel that starting to build in these verses because Narada Muni has already instigated how to speed things up, get Kamsa really angry, and get Kamsa to immediately send for Krishna and Balaram. So you have that feeling in the background, while in the foreground you're hearing about Krishna killing Keshi and Vyoma. But you know what's going to happen soon. Very soon, Vrindavan is going to be thrust into apparently the most bereaved, special condition of separation from Krishna. Any questions? Why I don't talk about Krishna's departure? Because that will be coming. You'll be hearing that in future classes. He wants to hear me talk about that. Today we're absorbed in hearing about Keshi. You should relish that too. Krishna's arm thrust, his left arm deep into the Keshi demon's mouth. That is very relishable. And all Keshi's teeth fall out. We can hear about that as well as the gopis. We relish hearing about Krishna grabbing Keshi's legs, whirling him around in the air, throwing him on the ground. And we can also speak, when appropriate, about Krishna's dearest consort. But today we're basically and mainly absorbed in the killing of Keshi, Kamsa's last hopes. I remember working at the BBT, assisting in producing Prabhupada's books in Los Angeles, and the artists were turning out so many pictures of Krishna dancing with the gopis. So Prabhupada sent a special letter saying, "Who's filling my books simply with pictures of Krishna dancing with the gopis? We want to see how Krishna controls everyone." So everything is there, and a devotee relishes everything that Krishna does while gradually in the mature stage developing his own particular taste. Now today we are concentrating mainly on Keshi, his mighty attack. Ordinarily Keshi is unconquerable and unapproachable, but he's dealing with the transcendental Krishna. So his being unconquerable and unapproachable will not help him today. Will not help him. And Krishna will have great fun killing him, suffocating the demon to death with his left hand down the demon's throat. He'll suffocate the demon. You'll hear that very wonderful description tomorrow. Krishna's arm, just think about Krishna's beautiful arm, blocking Keshi's breathing. Keshi's legs are kicking convulsively. His body becomes covered with sweat and his eyes are rolling around. Then the demon passes stool and falls on the ground dead. We can also relish this in Bhagavatam. Sanatana Goswami says every word of Bhagavatam is saturated with Krishna brain. So at the appropriate time, you'll hear about the details about Krishna's departure from Vrindavan. You'll hear about the accusations that the gopis make, accusing the demigods, accusing the elders of Vrindavan. Why doesn't someone stop this? How can they let this happen? Finally, they try even practically civil disobedience, and they try to surround the chariot and keep it from going. So you'll hear about that later. Any other questions?
Why Chandrika Krishna is not getting angry with the great demons? He says, why generally Lord Krishna is not angry with the matter? Well, I think the man will be with the demons. He's not getting angry.
He's also angry. We read. The Shastra says that. Text 4, you find, Tat-vachanyitva-tama-dokshajo-rusha. The transcendental Lord, Adokshaja, does something rusha, angrily. He angrily, the transcendental Lord angrily seizes Keshi by the legs. So that's also worshipable. We relish the anger of the Lord. He's angry. You just accept that. Don't try to explain away. He's compassionate, he's merciful. He's angry. Anything else? Yeah. You'll find that these wizards, they can maintain a huge form, but then when they start dealing with Krishna, their mystical power becomes bewildered. Just like when Puchana was being killed by Krishna, baby Krishna, she lost her demoniac composure to show herself as a beautiful woman, and she changed into a hideous demon. So Krishna throws these demons off balance. They can't maintain their material, mystic, psychic powers. All these demons, they're wizards sent by Kamsa, and these demons have the ability to assume various forms. Many people, when they give their reports about contacting aliens and UFOs, things like that, they say that the aliens, they're supposedly having the ability to change form. So that in UFO terminology, that's called shape-shifting. And people think this is very astonishing, but it's nothing astonishing. It's there in the Bhagavatam. It comes as wizards can change their shape, their form, according to the mission they want to do. But Krishna throws that off completely. He disrupts it. And so often they can't maintain their the way that they originally planned to attack Krishna. Puchana is a good example of that. She couldn't maintain going on as a beautiful woman. She was so terrified by Krishna's counterattack that she revealed her hideous form. Often you'll find in preaching that when devotees powerfully preach the message of Bhagavad Gita, then there's reactions. Material nature shows its real face. Who are you trying to shed enlightenment in the world of darkness? So therefore, it's not easy to preach all the time because there are reactions from material nature. What are you doing in Maya's kingdom trying to spread Krishna conscious knowledge? That's why a preacher has to be tolerant. Anything else? All right. All glories to the Prabhupada. Anyone?